From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, J.C. Knight joins us, channeling Ramtha. But here's what's happening. Well, a group of Mississippi ghost hunters made a scary discovery when they were snooping around near a shuttered hospital. They came upon the remains of a woman who had been abducted from her home. The body was found in a wooded area near the Kuhn Memorial Hospital, which has been a favorite haunt of ghost hunters because of the dark maze of rooms and its reputation as a hotbed of paranormal activity. The ghost hunters called police after finding a body that was determined by the state crime lab in Jackson to be that of 69-year-old Sharon Wilson, who had disappeared the day before. That's kind of an eerie discovery there. As the 4th of July weekend looms and Americans prep their grills and get ready for their fireworks, some citizens are also packing their bags. A recent online poll of more than 2,000 adults has revealed that 35% of American-born residents and immigrants would consider leaving the United States to live in another country. You know what? If that's what they want to do, let them go. Well, get ready for some Cuban cigars legally. President Obama has formally announced that the United States and Cuba have both agreed to open embassies in each other's capitals following more than a half a century of hostilities between the two nations. The U.S. Embassy in Havana is scheduled to open on July 20th. Jerry Corsi, who writes for WND.com and noted author. Jerry, this is a milestone indeed, but a lot of people aren't too happy about this. How come?
Well, George, there's still strong opposition to Castro and the nature of the regime. I mean, the Castro government is a communist government. It does repress its own citizens, and it has supported communist efforts in Latin America. Even recently, I mean, in June 4th, in the House, there was a 247-176 vote against opening travel to Cuba. Travel is still going to remain closed. That bill has got to be reconciled yet with the Senate. And we still have a trade embargo with Cuba. So there's a lot yet to do. But George, I think it's probably time we make some overtures to Cuba and try to get over the 50-year Cold War history and turn a new page, even though it's going to be a very controversial issue in many parts of the United States, including Florida, where there are many Cuban residents who are very, very strongly opposed and bitterly opposed to the Castro regime.
What I find just truly unbelievable, Jerry, is here's Castro in his 80s, and of course his brother's running the country, but Castro is too. And, I mean, this guy saw the Kennedy assassination. He witnessed that, Khrushchev, everything that we have gone through as a nation in terms of all the various presidents. Castro's still been there. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's phenomenal. I mean, Castro has been part of American politics since Dwight Eisenhower was president in the late 1950s and has lived through all these U.S. presidents. The opposition to Cuba has continued. Castro is kind of like the ever-ready bunny. He just keeps on going no matter what happens in the world. He's still there and is still in power, even though, as you say, his brother's running the country. But, George, I think it's, what President Obama is trying to do is to create a new era in relations with Cuba, and hopefully it can be successful, because the Castro brothers are not going to be forever in control of Cuba. And we, I think, can establish a positive atmosphere for freedom that can succeed the Castros. And that surely is the hope of the Obama administration. I think it's one that is worthy of support.
Jerry, why don't you run with something that you and I talked about many months ago, and that was with our program, with WND. Maybe you and I can go down to Cuba and interview Fidel Castro. We'll get a video camera. We'll get our audio recordings, and you'll be there. I'll be there. And let's see if we can pull that off. You want to run with that?
I think it's really time to do that. I'll make some serious efforts, George, in the next week or two to see if we can't get arrangements to go down there and get approval to go down and interview Castro. I'll make a major effort to see if with WND's support we can't do that. It would be a great idea And I think you and I could do a great interview. It would be very interesting to see Castro's reaction to President Obama's overtures to open relations with Cuba.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jerry. Jerry Corsi, WND.com. The number of applications of gun carry permits in Washington, D.C. more than tripled in the aftermath of a federal court ruling declaring part of the city's law unconstitutional. Now, between January 1st and May 18th this year, the city received 45 permit applications. That's it. However, after the judge ruled that the good reason clause contained within the city's carry law was unconstitutional on May 18th, the applications increased significantly. Just between May 18th and June 26th, the city received 140 applications there. The World Health Organization, they're saying the animal health director is saying that the wider international cooperation to avoid the spread of animal diseases that could be used as biological weapons, 60% of human diseases come from animal agents, and 80% of those agents could be used for bioterrorism of animal origin. Gary Ridenour, of course, an expert on pandemics. Gary, this is serious stuff. I did not think an animal virus like this could be used as a bioterrorism device.
Well, bioterrorism goes back as far as at least the Romans, when they put dead cows in the bodies of their enemy and throw them back over the wall into the town to cause disease. So it's been well known for a long time. Jeez. And using animals is the way to go because biologicals are cheap, easy to make, easy to smuggle, and they're easy to spread.
And they spread fast, I take it, don't they?
Yeah, they do, and especially if you've got people running around, you know, spreading that. And international cooperation is an oxymoron. And these countries that are going to come together are going to raise their hands and cross their fingers on the other hand and say, I promise we won't do this. And there's no penalty. It's just a promise that they won't do that. And this year, the U.S. military accidentally sent live anthrax samples to five countries and 17 labs in the United States. We also sent out a cookbook for the avian flu. Remember that one?
I sure do. Unbelievable.
You know, so I'm getting the point where we have met the enemy, and he is us.
He's within. Gary, thanks so much. Gary's website and Jerry Corsi's you'll find on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Police searching for a man in a wheelchair who is suspected of robbing a New York bank and then rolling out of the building with $1,200 in cash in what they say was a clean getaway. The New Horizons spacecraft has made its last planned targeting maneuver as it bears down on Pluto. The probe is due to scream past the dwarf world on July 14th at an altitude of just 12,500 kilometers. We'll monitor that story for you on Coast to Coast AM. SEAL Team 6. Up next, we talk call sign, Extortion 17, the shootdown of SEAL Team 6. Don Brown joins me. Get ready for this riveting interview on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Don Brown's going to be with us for a couple of hours tonight. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a former U.S. Navy JAG officer. That's a lawyer who has served in the Pentagon, where he provided legal advice to the Secretary of the Navy and the Judge Advocate General of the Navy. He now writes legal and military thrillers about the Navy. In so doing, he has developed a track record for future events in his novels as well. Don, I want to bring you in and thank you for serving, by the way.
George, good evening to you, and happy Independence Day weekend to you and the millions of your wonderful listeners. Thanks for having me.
You know, I spent 9 years in the Navy. One more year, I would have been a lieutenant commander. It started conflicting with my professional life, and I had to do my little 9 years and out, but I had a great time doing it, Don.
Well, thank you for your service, too, and it's good to speak with another Navy man tonight, George.
Absolutely. I did a little work at the Pentagon as well. I was there in 1983 or 4. Would you have been there at that time?
No, we were there a few years apart, but once you've been to the building, you've been to Ground Zero, you've seen the whole drill, and it's quite an experience. It certainly is.
Yeah, it is. Now, tell me a little bit more about yourself, Don.
I served 5 years active and another 11 in the reserves. Now I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, and started to write really military thrillers in 2005. My first work of fiction was released with Zondervan, now HarperCollins Christian Fiction, entitled Treason. It examined the issue at the time of radical Islamic infiltration of the U.S. military, and continued to write a series of books following that. And there have been 11 books published altogether, 10 primarily of fiction with HarperCollins and Mountain View Press, and now a Call Sign Extortion 17, which you had mentioned, which was just released at the end of May, about a month ago.
Well, it's a great job. This is a movie, by the way, so keep your fingers crossed on this one, Don.
Well, unfortunately, Call Sign Extortion 17 is not a work of fiction, but yes, it would be certainly very riveting on the big screen and probably needs to be done.
It sure does. Tell me a little bit about SEAL Team 6.
SEAL Team 6 is the colloquial name used for the United States Navy Developmental Warfare Group, which is in Little Creek, Virginia. It is one of several SEAL teams, but SEAL Team 6 is considered to be the elite of the elite. There are several squadrons that operate within SEAL Team 6, and they are certainly, we've heard all about them. We've seen the recent movie with Chris Kyle, but the SEAL teams operate in unconventional warfare, and they're the very finest of our special operations units. Of course, we have a number of excellent special operations units in the U.S. military, SEAL Team 6, Delta Force, U.S. Army Rangers, but they are considered the creme de la creme and are typically called upon when the United States needs to perform military feats that call for extraordinary achievement. We saw an example of that May 1st of this year, of 2011, when President Obama ordered SEAL Team 6 into Pakistan on a mission called Operation Neptune Spear to take out Osama bin Laden, which is one of the most recent of its most remarkable achievements.
And they're all men. I don't think we have any women as SEALs, or do we?
We do not have any that I'm aware of at this point. Of course, at some point, I'm sure that there is a push towards that. There was a very well-known movie a number of years ago, G.I. Jane, I think. But at this point, the SEAL team itself is all men. I think that's correct.
Now, let's talk about, of course, some of the tragedies that have been incurred because of this. And, of course, you key in on Afghanistan. Tell us this story. What was the mission?
Extortion 17 is the call sign for a United States Army National Guard helicopter, a Chinook CH-47D, which is essentially a troop chopper. The Chinooks have been around for a long time, since the Vietnam era. If you've ever seen one flying, they're large choppers, and you can put about 30 personnel on board, a little over that. And there is a forward propeller and a backward and aft propeller. The propellers, if you looked at them from above, resemble, they're three blades. They almost look like a peace sign, each one of the propellers. This particular mission originated in northeastern Afghanistan in Logar province, which is about 50 to 60 miles south of the capital of Kabul and bordering the Pakistani border. August the 6th, 2011, was 66 years to the date, interestingly, of the anniversary of our dropping an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and approximately 97 days after U.S. Navy SEALs had gone in to Pakistan and taken out Osama bin Laden. So in the northeastern sector of Pakistan, of Afghanistan, there had been firefights going on, off and on, off and on, where we were doing a lot of the same actions that we've been taking in Vietnam. We go in and take an area and then leave it and have to go in and resecure it because the local Afghan forces weren't able to hold it. Such was the case in this Tangi Valley. There had been a firefight going on in this Tangi River Valley in northeastern Afghanistan for several hours. And United States forces were ostensibly looking for a Taliban operative named Qari Tahir. And approximately 3 hours before this last fateful flight of Extortion 17, in which we lost, which was the deadliest loss of life, the greatest loss of life of American life in the Afghan War. We lost 30 Americans, primarily U.S. Navy SEALs, but not just Navy SEALs. There were also five find members of the Army National Guard flight crew and three U.S. Air Force special operations operators. Prior to that, there had been another mission flown by this helicopter and by a sister helicopter, codenamed Extortion 16, in which both of those helicopters lifted off from this forward operating base and took a group of U.S. Army Rangers to an area not far from where this fateful shootdown would take place, but not over the same type of hot zone. So 3 hours earlier, the helicopter had flown one mission. Then at 2:22 a.m. local time, we're going to give you local times so it's easier to kind of keep a grasp of, on August the 6th, the chopper takes off, and there are 30 Americans on board and 8 Afghans. Most of those Americans are U.S. Navy SEALs, 17 from SEAL Team 6. There are 5 additional U.S. Navy support personnel supporting the SEAL team. In addition to that, there are 3 United States Air Force special operators. These are pararescue operators. And then there is a 5-member United States Army National Guard flight crew, including 2 pilots and 3 support personnel on the back. In addition to that, there are 8 Afghans on board the chopper. Now, George, this was supposed to be a 10-minute flight from wheels up to wheels down.
Right.
So, yeah. The chopper takes off, heads, in a north westerly direction, and flying over parallel to a mountain ridge. And then, if you can imagine a fish hook, the flight pattern from the sky resembled a fish hook, with the operating base being at the eye of the hook where you would string the hook. It comes in a parallel pattern to this ridge and then begins to turn back in like a fishing hook would. And then at the spear of the hook, it comes over this hotly contested valley, this tangy valley. Now, to set the stage, on May the 11th, just about not quite 90 days earlier, U.S. military intelligence had intercepted message traffic from the Taliban that the Taliban was moving 100 additional fighters into this tangy valley with RPGs solely for the purpose of shooting down a United States helicopter with special operators on board.
And these are RPGs, for people who don't know, these are these shoulder harness type missiles, right?
Yes, and the acronym is rocket propelled grenade, correct. They are they don't have a lot of range, George. So if you're going to take out a chopper with an RPG, it is by necessity going to be a close-range shot.
Okay.
And they're not extremely accurate. Matter of fact, this particular RPG, the RPG-7, according to the military's own report, and I've examined over 1,200 pages of the military report, which had been classified and then strangely declassified, and that's another story in and of itself, the RPG has a maximum range of 170 meters, and that's it. But at any rate, this chopper turns in over this valley, and we have intercepted on May the 11th message traffic that they're bringing in 100 extra fighters with RPGs solely for the purpose of shooting down a chopper. The 90-day period between the bin Laden attack, in which we took out Osama bin Laden May the 1st, and then the last mission of Extortion 17, both involving members of SEAL Team 6, but not with an overlap, and I'll explain that just in a second. In other words, we don't believe there are any operators on board the Extortion 17 that went on the bin Laden raid, but they're part of the same team. There were 3 separate attacks against United States military helicopters over this small valley. And so we knew that it was a hot zone. It was an extreme hot zone. Now, part of the problem here, and I've outlined this in the book, but the first problem that we need to focus on is rules of engagement. The rules of engagement under which this helicopter was expected to operate were absolutely suicidal. We're in a situation where when the chopper takes off, George, of course, I said a moment ago, it is taking off. It has its sister chopper with Extortion 16. Now, the first thing to remember about that, when both of these choppers flew a mission 3 hours earlier, both of them had Rangers on board. In other words, the Ranger team was split half between Extortion 16 and half between Extortion 17. But in contrast, on this particular mission, for reasons unbeknownst to anyone, all the SEALs were jammed into Extortion 17, and Extortion 16, the sister chopper, which was in the air and available to transport troops, was empty,
except for
the flight crew. That's one of the many mysteries that surround this.
Stay with us, Don. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk more about your work, call sign Extortion 17. a riveting story, a sad story. 38 soldiers died in that episode. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Don Brown is with us. We're talking about his latest work, Call Sign Extortion 17. We are talking about the helicopter that was shot down in Afghanistan. 38 soldiers died. Some of them, of course, were Afghans. I think there were eight Afghans on that helicopter.
Correct. There were seven, yes. And again, we'll get that in a moment. Seven unidentified Afghans. We don't know who they were because of a security breach. Seven who were Afghan commandos, we think. We don't know who they were. And then the eighth was an interpreter, an Afghan interpreter. The other 30 were Americans.
Okay, so there were two helicopters. One was empty.
Right.
The other one, of course, Extortion 17, was loaded with everyone. And now, Taliban, they were spotted in that area. We weren't given permission to fire on them. How come?
That's a good question. Matter of fact, there are a total of five aircraft in the air, George, converging on this landing zone looking for this one guy. The two extortion, 16 and 17, 16 breaks off. But, George, extortion 17 goes in over this valley, accompanied, first off, by two Apache helicopters. If you know anything about an Apache helicopter, I know you do. It is a powerful baby. You know, they got Hellfire missiles, 70 rocket pods, machine guns. And then flying over that, there was an AC-130 gunship. And this is what you're referring to. The gunship was flying counterclockwise. The Apaches, the two Apaches in the gunship, had their eyes set on the landing zone that Extortion 17 is headed towards. This AC-130 gunship is seeing everything that's happening on the ground, and it sees Taliban. They call them squirters. That's the military acronym that's used in the air traffic control transcript. Moving towards the landing zone, the AC-130 gunship repeatedly requests permission to take out these Taliban moving toward the landing zone by foot, and inexplicably is denied permission to take these hostile forces out.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable.
They literally can see these Taliban, probably armed with their shoulder harness missiles and their rifles, running toward the landing spot where the helicopters are about ready to land, and we do nothing about it.
Yes, and part of the issue, of course, we know that this is this open season, the summer of 2011, was open season on U.S. choppers in Afghanistan. We already have had three choppers attacked, none shot down yet in this valley within the last 90 days before this chopper moves in. And we have on-the-record information and off-the-record information. The on-the-record information, the aircraft commander is testifying as part of the follow-up investigation, and he gratuitously adds to put on the record that we requested permission to fire on these squirters, he called them, and were denied. The navigator on the AC-130 also testified. Same thing. We were told we could not fire on them, only to try to monitor their position. And we know that as Extortion 17 was almost 8 minutes overdue, still hanging in the air, inexplicable delays hanging in the air, it was taken out at close range by an RPG. And you know, George, as a fellow naval officer and as a historian, that it's been a basic tenet of United States military doctrine, even going back to Gettysburg. You know, if you've ever been there, both sides are firing cannonade across the field, or at Iwo Jima, or at Normandy. We soften the beachhead before we put our troops in. That is a basic tenet of American military doctrine. In this case, the landing zone was not blasted. The very, you know, dangerous and hot, you know, valley was not cleared out. And as a result, these guys got shot down, and there's no viable explanation for it at all.
And was there ever any retaliation, Don, after the shootdown?
After the shootdown, it's interesting because as soon as the Apache helicopters, those two Apaches, by the way, who could have blasted the landing zone also, were not given permission, as soon as the shootdown occurred, one of the Apaches instinctively began firing into the landing zone. And the commander of that chopper was later raked over the coals as part of the investigation for firing into that landing zone and into the area around the landing zone without permission. So that happened. And then in addition to that, at 4:15 a.m., after the chopper, this chopper went down at approximately 2:40 a.m., 2:39 a.m., 12 seconds shy of 2:40 local time. We brought in, and there are contradictory reports as to what group arrived on the ground first. The official military report states that U.S. Army Rangers arrived first at 4:12 a.m. I don't have any reason to doubt that. I think there were groups, there was clearly units on the ground before that. That's kept out of the military report. That's another story. U.S. Army Pathfinders arrived minutes later at 4:15 a.m. by helicopter. The Pathfinders were flown in on a Black Hawk, and that Black Hawk got pre-suppression fire into their landing zone, as well they should have. But the rules of engagement changed within a matter of less than 2 hours, whereas the Black Hawk crew a team got pre-suppression fire and the SEALs did not. So it's totally inexplicable. We've had choppers fired at over that valley. One was hit, an MH-47 was hit just about 3 weeks earlier and made it back to base. We had another identical chopper on June the 6th, another CH-47D. They fired 14 RPGs and small arms fire at that, but fortunately that chopper was at an altitude that there was a miss. On June the 4th, there was an attack against a Black Hawk in which the RPG exploded within one rotor's length of that chopper and almost brought it down. And despite all that, we still are not giving pre-suppression fire to the SEAL team moving in, and it's absolutely inexcusable.
Don, wasn't this the single largest loss of life for U.S. Navy SEALs?
That is correct. The largest loss of life in the Afghan War for American forces, the single largest loss of life in the history of U.S. Navy SEALs. And unfortunately, George, and I'm so grateful that you are helping to bring attention to it tonight, but most Americans don't have a clue about it.
No.
And part of the reason I think it's been buried amongst other, flare-ups and national events that have occurred, and it's a real shame. But there needs to be a national discussion on the rules of engagement. And this case, this issue, this shoot down of this this helicopter with this loss of life of these Navy SEALs needs to be at the very center of it, because you cannot send your forces in to a hostile zone, especially a hostile zone like Afghanistan, with one hand tied behind their back. They're going to get killed. And this particular helicopter, this CH-47D, being a troop chopper, is not an offensive chopper. It has a 240 caliber machine gun, which is very defensive in nature, but it can't stand the Snowbird's chance against rockets fired against it, against RPGs fired against it. And if you don't clear those landing zones out, anybody can take a point-blank shot and bring it down.
Yeah.
And there needs to be a national discussion on that issue.
There's something very sad about out of sight, out of mind, Don, with the American public, that if an issue isn't constantly bombarding them and it goes away, if the media basically forgets it, it's done. It's gone.
That's correct. And in this case, there was very little attention paid to it to begin with. I mean, certainly there was some national coverage, but part of the issue here is that there was an investigation ordered the day following the shootdown on August the 7th by General James Mattis, who at that time was CENTCOM, the four-star Marine Corps. He was a Marine Corps general, four-star general officer overseeing CENTCOM there at MacDill Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
He ordered a one-star Brigadier General, Army Brigadier Jeffrey Colt, to go to Afghanistan and to initiate an investigation. George, this investigation lasted 5 weeks, from August the 7th, the day after the shootdown, until September the 13th of 2011. At the conclusion of the investigation, there was an executive summary indicating no one was at fault. It was just one of those things that happened in the fog of war. So there is an investigation which basically did not address the rules of engagement, nor did it even address the fact that the AC-130 had seen Taliban moving. All that was left out of the official report. And the thing, and as I said a moment ago, it's one of the strange turn of events in this case, is that 1 month after the investigation was closed, bear in mind it was closed in September 13th of 2011, in October 2011, the military had brought in family members of the guys that lost their lives on board this chopper for a briefing at Little Creek, Virginia, which, as you know, is where SEAL Team 6, or the DEVGRU, is headquartered. And during the course briefing, somehow, some way, someone had taken 1,250 pages of information concerning testimony, exhibits examined, forensic stuff, all this evidence, which 1 month earlier had been classified as top secret, somehow was declassified and given to some of these family members on a flash drive.
Oh,
now, that's a mystery. I suspect senior enlisted and mid-level officers, to be honest with you. But somebody wanted this information out. And so one of the reasons, I think, is that that you haven't had, you know, much more attention on it is because there was a delay, and I'm grateful that the family members got this disc, but there was a delay in getting it to them, and everything sort of died down, other things were happening. But some of the family members began to look at the disc and discovered some serious irregularities, and one thing led to another, and now we know that there's no reason these guys should have died, George, none whatsoever.
We're with Don Proud, of course. His book is called Call Sign Extortion 17. What about the bodies? Were we ever able to extract them and get them out of there?
The status of the bodies is, again, one of the many unanswered questions. Now, on August the 9th, 2011, the 30 bodies of the Americans, along with 8 Afghans, were flown to Dover Air Base. I raised the question, why are you bringing Afghans back to the United States? But all 38 were flown to Dover Air Base. On that day, August the 9th, the Pentagon, through its spokesman at the time, Marine Lieutenant Colonel David Lapin, announced that due to the nature of the shootdown, and here were his words, there are no identifiable remains. So the Pentagon makes the claim initially that there are no identifiable remains. In addition, some of the family members are told that their sons are being cremated, which caused a bit of a brouhaha in and of itself. So we have on August the 9th the claim there are no identifiable remains, and some family members being said that their sons are going to be cremated. Now then, remember that in October, this flash drive was given to family members, 2 months after the Pentagon makes the claim no identifiable remains. I've read all the evidence, and there was testimony taken from U.S. Army pathfinders on the scene. The pathfinders, the pathfinders were on the scene, and the testimony given by the J3 officer indicates that at least 8 of the men were found outside the chopper. They were not even hardly burned, and they were clearly identifiable. So we have an irreconcilable conflict between what the Pentagon told us August the 9th and what we know to be true from what the pathfinders found on the scene. We have at least 8 bodies that were clearly identifiable. We don't know if the bodies were cremated or not. You know, I've got some evidence that some possibly were not, but we don't know. In July of 2013, Congressman Jacob Chaffetz of Utah, who would later conduct a nominal hearing in February of 2014, made the comment to Bob Cusack, who was a writer for the publication The Hill in Washington, D.C. He made this comment. He said, "The body I saw did not need to be cremated." That comment was made in July 2013 by the congressman whose committee was investigating this, implying that bodies had been cremated. Now, he didn't actually come out and say it, but the military has never said what happened to the bodies. Part of the issue with cremation, George, is that if you cremate, you destroy DNA evidence. If you
don't have DNA evidence,
you don't know who's who. And one of the big questions here, why do we have 7 unidentified Afghans on board that chopper? So it remains a big mystery today. There was a hearing, as I mentioned a moment ago, February the 27th, 2014, conducted by Congressman Jacob Chaffetz's Subcommittee on National Security, part of the House Oversight Committee. At that hearing, which lasted a little bit over an hour and a half, the military presented 5 witnesses. And we've seen these congressional hearings. They all swear to tell the truth. They all sit on the other side of the table. They get asked questions by congressmen. Those 5 witnesses, George, 2 were civilians. One was an administration appointee working in the Pentagon named Gary Reed, a deputy secretary of defense and for low-intensity conflict. He's got a lot of stuff in his title. You know how that is. The second civilian testifying, George, was a lady who was in charge of Pentagon mortuary affairs, funeral expert. And then the only 3 military personnel were officers. The officers in charge of the Navy, Army, and Air Force Mortuary Affairs Division. So at the hearing, we have 5 witnesses, one who's a political appointee, and four who are funeral experts. There is not a single witness from Afghanistan who saw anything, not a single witness concerning rules of engagement, no discussion on that. And, George, there's not a single question from a single member of the Congress in that committee as to what happened to the bodies after there had been an issue on the status of the bodies. That's an issue that needs to be addressed, and it hasn't been, and we don't know what happened.
What is happening to date now, Don, with this entire situation? Has it all been swept under the old carpet, or is it alive?
I mean, at this point, it appears to have been swept under the carpet. Of course, my book is out, and it's raising some additional questions. What I'm hoping, you know, really, in my opinion, the Armed Services Committee of the Standing Armed Services Committee of the House or the Senate should reopen the investigation and have some very open and frank public discussions on the rules of engagement. There needs to be some answers given as to why we aren't giving pre-suppression fire, you know, into that landing zone. There needs to be some answers as to why the rules of engagement were set so that the AC-130 could not take out Taliban moving toward the landing zone. I've looked at the internal report, and there was a claim made by Mr. Reed, for example, at the hearing, that the RPG that took this chopper out was fired from a Quallet hut some 220 meters away. All right? First off, when you look, there is a Joint Combat Assessment Team which worked under the jurisdiction of General Colt to reassemble everything, to interview everybody. They were the principal on-ground investigators, and this Joint Combat Assessment Team and the military evidence said that no one could identify the point of origin of the RPG, that no one saw it. Yet Mr. Reed said in his hearing that it was fired from a Quallet hut 220 meters away. But, George, remember a second ago when I was talking about this RPG-7, it only has a maximum effective range of 170 meters.
Yeah, it would have died out before it even got to it.
Sure, but see, if you claim that it was fired from a Quallet hut 220 meters away, then you're essentially saying it was fired outside of the landing zone, and you're essentially saying it would have done no good to have cleared the landing zone.
Right.
But we know, basically, because this chopper was between 100 and 150 feet off the deck, and that's what the military, that's what the JCAT investigation, Joint Combat Assessment Team, concludes, 100 to 150 feet off the deck when it was shot down. We know the angle of strike. And when you know the altitude and the angle of strike, all you got to do is apply a little basic mathematics, and you can determine the approximate distance that the RPG was from the chopper. It was at point blank range, obviously in the landing zone. Obviously, in that valley, it should have been cleared out.
What would you say, Don, has been the most disturbing portion of this story that you were able to uncover?
Well, my book does a couple of things. One, it's one thing that needed to happen is there needed to be a historical account put together of this incident, because there is historical importance to it being the largest loss of life. And one thing that is absolutely uncontroverted is the refusal by the chain of command to allow that AC-130 to take out these Taliban operatives. Absolutely disturbing and infuriating. So the centerpiece of the complaint against the military are the rules of engagement that were set. The reversal of the rules that do not allow us to soften the beachhead, that is inexcusable. Now, the second thing the book does is it asks a lot of questions that should have been asked by the military investigative team that were not asked, and by the United States Congress that weren't asked. Like, what happened to the black box? Like, what happened to the status of the bodies? Like, you know, we found bullets in some of the bodies, and those bullets were thrown away. No questions were asked. So the book asks a number of questions that still need to be asked, but the one inexcusable, incontrovertible thing to take away is that our military is being forced, and the very finest special operators we have from SEAL Team 6 are being forced to fly into a hot zone where a battle had been taking place for 3 hours and we had tons of firepower from that AC-130.
Without cleaning it out. That's the thing. Don, hold on. We're at the break. We're going to come back with more, and we'll take some phone calls, too, from those of you that just really, really are concerned about this whole thing.